Few would argue that modern technology makes life much easier than our forefathers had it. But is that necessarily a good thing? One might say that it absolutely is, when talking about what technology has done for the medical field and the benefit to human life. Technology makes travel and communication a normal part of our everyday activities. But is there a danger that is hidden in our usage of technology that we are overlooking? How dependent have we become upon modern conveniences, such as electricity? How do we know if there is danger lurking beneath the surface? One way to understand this issue is to imagine what America would be like if there was a prolonged blackout due to the loss of America's electrical grid. What would America look like after 1 year of very limited to no electrical power? Those, my friends, are questions that deserve serious answers. Stay tuned for my conversation with Dr. Peter Pry next on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, Dolores said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Soaring Eagle Radio Show. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. You may follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You may listen to every episode on our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com. And, of course, tune in on WTTP FM 101.1 in the Lima area to hear this show on Saturday and Sunday. My guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum, both Congressional Advisory Boards, and served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of the following books, Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, Electric Armageddon, and his most recent book, Blackout Wars. And all of these are available from createspace.com as well as amazon.com. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Dr. Pry.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate you accepting the invitation. There are man-made EMPs, electrical magnetic pulse, and naturally occurring electrical magnetic phenomena. I'd like to start our conversation today talking about EMPs first. And for our listeners, Peter, if you would, explain what exactly is an EMP? And how has the theory and the technology behind EMPs evolved?
Well, I don't know how much technical detail you want to get into, but going into physics 101, an electromagnetic pulse is basically caused by a moving magnetic field. A moving magnetic field will make electrons move in a wire, thereby cause an electric current to flow in a wire. That's what it really all boils down to. So So if you understand how a lawnmower works, you can understand EMP.
Hmm.
When you go and pull the cord on a lawnmower, you're causing a cluster of magnets called a magneto to spin. And that causes a moving magnetic field. And the magnets are surrounded by a coil. That's a coil of wires.
Yes.
And that moving magnetic field causes the electrons to move in that wire. In other words, it induces electrical current in the coil. And it generates a small electromagnetic pulse that you can see in the form of a spark in the spark plug of the lawnmower. Now, the Earth is a giant magnet. It's got a north and a south pole, and it's surrounded by a magnetic field that we call the magnetosphere. And when the sun throws out a coronal mass ejection, that is, some people call it a solar flare, but the correct scientific name is a coronal mass ejection. It's a blob of ionized particles that will travel, on average, about 1,000,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
This enormous blob, on occasion, it'll strike the Earth. It's basically the sun, and when it throws out a coronal mass ejection, is hurling out from a sunspot, it's hurling out a huge chunk of itself. And the reason we're not all burned to death is because we're protected by the magnetosphere. But in the course of saving us, the magnetosphere, when it gets slammed by this huge coronal mass ejection traveling 1,000,000 miles an hour, it gets distorted. It moves around. It waffles back and forth. And it causes it generates a geomagnetic storm, which is basically a natural EMP. Geomagnetic storms happen regularly.
Yeah.
In 1989, there was a Hydro-Quebec storm that blacked out half Canada. But what we're really concerned about in the case of a geomagnetic storm, a natural EMP, is the rare geomagnetic superstorm like the 1859 Carrington.
Yes. Yeah.
Which would cause a EMP that could affect everything on Earth and would be so powerful it could collapse electric grids everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how an EMP works in nature.
Yes.
Man can create, in effect, a geomagnetic storm, too, when you waft a nuclear weapon at high altitude, above an altitude of 30 kilometers. If you insert that nuclear weapon into the magnetosphere, the expanding fireball from the nuclear weapon will cause that magnetosphere to waffle around. It'll deform the magnetosphere, cause it to vibrate as it were. And so you can generate a geomagnetic storm on the surface of the Earth. If the altitude is high enough and you're using a powerful enough weapon, a single nuclear weapon could cause a geomagnetic storm-like phenomenon across the entire continental United States, destroying electronics everywhere. Now, it's a little more complicated than that when it comes to nuclear weapons, because a nuclear EMP is a little more complicated than the EMP generated by nature. You get almost exactly the same natural EMP that a geomagnetic storm creates, but there's another phenomenon that happens called the Compton effect. The gamma rays that come off of the nuclear weapon that are generated during the first billionth of a second of the nuclear detonation will knock electrons off of molecules high in the atmosphere. And these will spin at the speed of light around the Earth's lines of geomagnetic force, causing a very intense high-frequency electromagnetic field in addition to the geomagnetic storm-type EMP that you get. And this can couple into very small objects like the personal computer on your desk, or into automobiles, or into SCADA systems, that is, the little computers that control everything. They control the way water flows through a pipe or the way electricity flows through a power line. So all kinds of electronics get put at risk by that high-frequency, very powerful EMP that is generated basically by nuclear weapons. And you can also create that. It's called an E1 EMP, that part. That can also be created by non-nuclear weapons called radio-frequency weapons that use microwave-type technology to generate a localized electromagnetic pulse that has high frequency, and it can couple into really small objects, including pacemakers in people's bodies.
Wow.
That, fortunately, doesn't have a very long range.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, a radio frequency weapon has a range of less than a kilometer.
Hmm.
But still, if you understood how the grid worked and you had enough of these, you could cause a nationwide catastrophe.
Yes.
So those are the three kinds of EMP that we most worry about. The natural EMP that can be caused by the sun, by geomagnetic storms. Nuclear EMP that can be caused by the high altitude detonation of a nuclear weapon. And the EMP that can be generated by radio frequency weapons that are not nuclear weapons.
Excellent. Now, NASA, I believe it was a couple of years ago now, Peter, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they stated in a report that the Earth narrowly missed one of these natural superstorms you're talking about. I think it was 2012. Does that sound familiar?
That's correct. I believe it was on the 25th of July in 2012.
Yeah.
A coronal mass ejection of the kind that caused the 1859 Carrington event.
Yeah.
This was a huge, very powerful coronal mass ejection. It just crossed the path of the Earth by 3 days. It missed us by just 3 days.
Mm.
And so we had a very close call with a natural EMP catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
NASA and other scientists who examined that said that if that had hit the Earth, it would collapse electric grids and critical infrastructures that support life everywhere on the planet.
Wow.
Put billions of lives at risk.
Yeah.
In fact, it would have threatened the existence of modern civilization everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And threatened the lives of people who even don't live in modern societies, since mm-hmm. they also have become heavily dependent upon the food, for example, that is produced and medicines that are produced by advanced societies.
Yes.
NASA estimates that the likelihood of the occurrence of a geomagnetic superstorm like the Carrington event, is 12% per decade, because we're overdue to experience one of those.
Mm.
They happen about once every century or so. So 12% per decade, we're overdue.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have to be an astrophysicist to do the arithmetic. 1859 was more than a century ago.
Yeah.
So we're overdue for the recurrence of a Carrington-class geomagnetic mm-hmm. superstorm, and it almost happened a couple of years ago, which narrowly got missed. 12% per decade is a very high likelihood, because that indicates the arithmetic works out so that within our lifetime, so that our children,
mm-hmm.
We will inevitably experience a Carrington-class geomagnetic superstorm, the 1859 Carrington event.
Yes. Well, we're going to loop back and talk about some of the things that we can do to prepare for that, but I think our conversation so far has provided a good segue into the subject of American security as it relates to the electrical grid. And I think perhaps would be beneficial for our listeners. I know your book, Blackout Wars, really gave a great explanation of exactly what the threat is in real terms, not hypothetical, not theory, but real terms based on some of the things that are going on in our world today that people are not aware of, surprisingly. So I'm wondering if you would give a synopsis of Blackout Wars, Peter, for our listeners, so they can get a real grasp on the security issues that we have.
Well, one of the issues that the Blackout Wars is concerned about, we are concerned about the natural EMP threat, but we're just as concerned about man-made threat to the electric grid, which includes not just EMP, but a new way of warfare that's been developed by the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians, and by terrorists as well. They all are looking to this new way of warfare that has been developed by the Russians. Basically their military doctrine and exercises they write about all is built on General Vladimir Slepchenko's book called No Contact Wars, where he describes sixth-generation warfare. And this entails attacking the electric grid as a means of bringing a civilization to its knees. They describe this as a revolution in military affairs, which is a period in history. Revolution in military affairs, the Russian military doctrine, is the use of new technologies and strategies that are so decisive, that they basically can cause a historical watershed in history where one civilization can replace another civilization by means of this kind of warfare. And that, you know, a blackout war is envisioned by Russia, China, and Iran, terrorists, North Korea, you know, would start perhaps with bad weather, a heat wave, a hurricane, some natural phenomena, a geomagnetic storm, something that puts stress on the grid naturally. Then that would be followed by cyber attacks, computer viruses and hackings that would attack the control systems within the electric grid, which is already being stressed by Mother Nature. On top of this, they would conduct physical sabotage, commando operations, for example, could go in with rifles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and attack extra-high-voltage transformers, control stations, SCADA farms, you know, to try to damage physically by kinetic attacks key parts of the electric grid to try to bring it down. Non-nuclear radio frequency weapons would use non-nuclear EMP to attack the grid. And then the ultimate cyber threat, because this is all falls under the rubric of cyber warfare doctrine, as it is thought of by the Russians, Chinese, and our other potential adversaries, the ultimate cyber weapon, in their view, is a nuclear EMP attack. Now, any one of these things, you know, cyber attacks, physical sabotage, non-nuclear EMP weapons, certainly nuclear EMP, any one of these could take down the grid, cause a protracted blackout that would kill millions of Americans and enable the bad guys to end our civilization and replace one civilization with another. But used in combination, it's an irresistible formula, you know, to guarantee the destruction of the grid and the collapse of society. One of the reasons they consider this the most decisive revolution of military affairs in history is because attacking a society in this way would enable you to prevail in a day. You know, you would basically bring the society to its knees in a day by taking away the critical infrastructures. The other thing that is unprecedented in history about this is it enables you, the reason Slepchenko calls it no-contact wars, is there's no contact, you know, between the military establishments of the sides. They're basically using means to attack our electric grid and other critical infrastructures that go around our military defenses and attack us in our Achilles heel, which is our technology. So there is no military contact between the sides. And another factor that makes it a decisive kind of military operation that has no precedent in history is that they are throwing their best technology and their best warriors, that is to say their cyber warriors, their nuclear warriors, against an aspect of our society that's completely unprepared for this, because our electric grid and our other civilian critical infrastructures like our communication system, our transportation system, food and water, business and finance, all these things that sustain our modern civilization, these are all outside our national security culture. No, they are not run or regulated or defended even by the Department of Defense, except indirectly. And, you know, the only defense they've got are private contractors that they may have hired to try to ward off cyber attacks, for example. But this is the cyber equivalent of the Kmart guard that would be going up against the elites, the elite technology and the elite personnel of the adversary. So it's a mismatch unique in history. And because of this, it creates another thing that would be unique in history, because we've now arrived at a place, because of this technological Achilles heel, where failed states like Iran or North Korea, or even a non-state actor like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, could take down the most successful societies on Earth. We've never faced a situation like that before in history. In the past, you know, in order to take out the most advanced civilizations in history, the other side also had to be accomplished and sophisticated, like Nazi Germany. Evil as they were, they had great means of production, they were strong industrially, they were advanced scientifically, and something like a parity in technological and military means was necessary in the past to threaten the Western democracies. Not so now, not under the context of a blackout war.
Right.
Because of this technological vulnerability. Now somebody like ISIS could conceivably take out the United States.
Yeah. And that that theory is being put to the test, really. It's fair to say that today China, Russia, and even North Korea to an extent are probing our security, our infrastructure, to see what kind of responses they receive, and really that's just the tip of the spear, isn't it?
That's correct. And Iran and terrorists too. You know, we are, our electric grid and other critical infrastructures are under constant attack from all these actors, including non-state terrorist actors. And they've actually had some successes that haven't received a lot of attention. For example, in 2013, the Knights Templars, who are basically a drug cartel in Mexico, they attacked part of the Mexican electric grid and put nearly 500,000 people into the dark, so they could go into towns and villages and execute local leaders opposed to the drug trade.
Yeah.
You know, when Neanderthals, like the, who are unsophisticated actors, you know, like the Knights Templars, who figured out that the electric grid is a major societal vulnerability, what can more sophisticated actors, much more sophisticated actors like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Iran, North Korea, what could they do and what are their plans? And in fact, we have actually seen what they can do, and what some of their plans are. In June of 2014, when everybody's attention was focused on ISIS sweeping through northern Iraq, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula used mortars and rocket-propelled grenade launchers to temporarily black out the entire nation of Yemen. It's the first time in history that a terrorist group has blacked out an entire nation. And Yemen, it's a nation of 18 cities and 24 million people, and they blacked out temporarily the whole nation. Now, this had the profound geopolitical consequences because it destabilized the Yemeni government, which was allied to the United States, an important ally in the war on terror, and it caused that government to collapse. So they were basically taken over by terrorist groups that are sympathetic to Iran and supported by Iran. So here you had a blackout war happen right under our noses, where an important ally has been knocked out, and it has received very little attention or commentary in the Western press. This is such a sophisticated and new thing that hasn't sunk into the heads of the mainstream media to follow news stories. Earlier in last year, in March of last year, an alleged Iranian cyber attack temporarily blacked out most of the nation of Turkey. Turkey is a NATO ally, and it caused a lot of economic disruption and chaos in Turkey, and it may have moved the Turks, a crucial ally of ours, both in NATO and to supporting our military operations in the Middle East. It may have made the Turks much more reluctant to cooperate with us in the war against ISIS and in our Middle Eastern operations, you know, because they suddenly realized how vulnerable they are to their potential adversaries. And most recently, just before Christmas, on the 23rd of December, Russia blacked out part of the Ukrainian grid, Western Ukraine, put almost 1 million homes into the dark. Again, these were temporary blackouts. Yeah. All of them weren't catastrophic in terms of causing large losses of life.
Yeah.
But they demonstrate the potentiality of this new way of warfare.
Yes.
They weren't using everything. Some of them were just sabotage. Others were just cyber attacks. North Korea has actually practiced all three, including the nuclear EMP attack against us back in 2013. They orbited a satellite over us during the worst ever nuclear crisis we had with North Korea, when they were threatening to make nuclear missile strikes.
Yeah.
And in the midst of that crisis, they launched a satellite called the KSM-3. It did the classic, passed over the South Pole, and simulated a surprise nuclear EMP attack against the United States. If there was a warhead in that satellite, you know, they could have put an EMP field over all 48 contiguous United States.
Yeah.
And the KSM-3 is still up there. It orbits over us every few days.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, I compare this to what Nazi Germany was doing during the period 1936 to 1939,
mm-hmm.
when they were exercising, they were conducting exercises, and they actually experimented with the Blitzkrieg, which was an earlier revolution in military affairs, a new way of warfare.
Yes.
That used armor combined with fast-moving infantry and artillery and air power in combination in a new way that the Allies did not understand. A handful of far-sighted Western leaders like Winston Churchill and Major General Fuller saw it coming, but they were a small minority, and people didn't listen to them.
Right.
You know, most elites like Neville Chamberlain and the British General Staff and most people in America thought that World War II, the next war, would be fought the way World War I was fought. It would be static trench warfare with barbed wire, trenches, and machine guns. But the Blitzkrieg was designed to decisively defeat that kind of war,
yeah.
the older version of war. Mm-hmm. The Nazis nearly succeeded in conquering the world with this revolution in military affairs. The only reason we stopped them was because we learned to fight a better Blitzkrieg, and it cost us and the Russians, you know, cost us thousands of lives, cost the Russians millions of lives to learn to fight a better Blitzkrieg. But before the Blitzkrieg was unleashed on the Western democracies in 1939, Nazi Germany had experimented in the Spanish Civil War with the Blitzkrieg to prove that it worked. And I think that that's where we are. We're sort of in the period, pre-war period, where the bad guys are experimenting bits and pieces in a low-profile way to prove out their doctrine, to learn how to do it better, to make sure that it works. And I think they're meeting with this success.
Mm-hmm.
And they're managing to do it in a way, unfortunately, that isn't being noticed by our Western elites, including attacks right on the United States. For example, the famous attack that happened last summer, or at least it came to public light last summer, where China had stolen sensitive information on 30 million federal employees.
Yes.
You know, it caused a lot of newspaper headlines. It was covered by the press.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of hoopla about it, and people, you know, were worried about, what does this signify? And then, because people haven't thought this through and what it means in terms of their military doctrine and planning, it went off the front pages, and now everybody's forgotten about that.
Right.
Just sort of the way people forgot about what was going on with Nazi Germany and the Blitzkrieg from 1936 to 1939 and couldn't put the pieces together. It was a failure of strategic imagination before World War II that nearly cost the Western democracies their lives. And I think that that's where we stand today. There's a profound failure of strategic imagination among the Western democracies today.
Yeah.
Where when we think of cyber warfare, we're thinking of it narrowly in terms of computer viruses attacking, and that it won't be any worse than what we see happening on a small scale or more limited type scales, like stealing information and things like that, temporary blackouts and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We don't get that what they have in mind is a much more ambitious combined arms operation. They start with cyber,
yes.
but includes sabotage, non-nuclear EMP, and then ultimately a nuclear EMP attack.
Yes.
And that would basically end us as a civilization in 24 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, that deserves some follow-up, too. And I know you have some statistics to share with our listeners. The U.S. Federal Regulatory Commission issued a report recently that suggested, among other things, that if as few as 9 key transformer substations were destroyed, the result would be a blackout in the entire country that might take as much as 18 months to rectify it. Is that an accurate statement, Peter?
Well, that's right. In fact, there wasn't any might about it, though. They estimated that it would cause a blackout that would last 18 months, and that we wouldn't be able to rectify it before then.
Yeah.
And that alone, as I mentioned before, any one of these things, sabotage, cyber, nuclear EMP, would be sufficient to end us as a society. Used in combination, is irresistible. Because the EMP commission on which I served estimated that if you had a nationwide blackout that lasted one year, okay, up to 9 of 10 of Americans could die from starvation, disease, and societal collapse. You know, we only have enough food in the country for 30 days in the big regional food warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't be brought to market. You can't replenish the food in the grocery stores. Your local grocery store only has enough food under conditions of normal consumption for about 3 days. After that, it has to be resupplied from these big regional food warehouses, where we have about a 30-day national food supply. After 30 days, that's it. You know, we don't have any more food. And we haven't... the thing that enables us to support a population of 320 million people is our technology and the fact that we have, you know, high-tech food storage systems, food distribution systems. You know, we have not planned in our national security for protracted blackouts, you know, where we would need a more than a 30-day food supply.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things, immediate water. You know, lack of water can kill people even more quickly than a lack of food. And immediately you would lose your water supply.
Yes.
You know, because when there's no electricity, you won't have running water.
Right.
Nor will the water be purified.
Mm-hmm.
And even lakes and rivers, which are dangerous to drink under normal conditions right now, would become far more dangerous to drink in the aftermath of a protracted blackout, because what happens is the water purification plants, the wastes in the water purification plants,
yep,
back up into lakes and rivers.
Yes.
And make them even more dangerously polluted than they,
yeah,
are now. So the human wastes, the hospital wastes, the industrial wastes and heavy metals, you know, flow back into those bodies of water.
Yes. Well, that paints a pretty disturbing picture, Peter. 9 out of 10 Americans within the first year would die. And, of course, go ahead.
Let me add a few other things to,
sure,
make the picture a little more realistic and disturbing. If you just think through some of this, how about the nuclear reactors? You know, the nuclear reactors,
yeah,
need an electric grid that operates in order to cool their cores and in order to cool the fuel rods. You know, they only have enough emergency fuel and their batteries to keep them cool that will last 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
After 7 days, the over 100 nuclear reactors in the United States could go Fukushima and spread radioactive waste everywhere, which,
mm-hmm,
would be carried by the winds, you know, moving from west to east.
Yeah.
Most of the nuclear reactors are co-located with population centers,
yeah,
in the eastern half of the United States. So this would greatly complicate the ability to survive and recover, because you'd have radioactivity, including radioactive hotspots, all over the place. The gas lines, natural gas pipelines, the SCADAs spark and would cause huge fires. You could have firestorms in cities from gas pipeline explosions, chemical factories, with SCADAs and sparking there, you'd end up having explosions in chemical factories. Think of the oil refineries. I mean, these are just highly sophisticated,
yes,
enormous chemistry sets.
That's right.
You know, that are,
yeah,
just waiting for an EMP to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd end up with toxic clouds all over the place. So when you lose the electricity, and one last thing I'll mention as an example of the kinds of things that happen, you know, at any given moment, as you and I are speaking right now, there's 500,000 people flying over the skies of the United States, carried by over 1,000 airliners.
Yeah.
In the nuclear EMP scenario, most or all of those airplanes could come crashing down.
Yeah.
And immediately you'd have the loss of the 500,000 people who are in the air,
yeah,
not to mention what would happen on the ground. You know, some of those airplanes are going to land in the population centers.
Yes.
So the way to think of this new way of warfare, when you have a blackout, protracted blackout, it's not just an absence of the convenience of having the electric grid.
Yeah.
You know, there are catastrophic consequences associated with the loss of electricity.
That's right.
You know, some people kind of inaccurately described it as putting the whole country into a giant time machine and sending this back a century, you know, to the time before we had electricity. I wish that were the case,
right,
you know, because,
right,
we'd have a better chance of surviving.
That's right.
What you're doing is you're not in the environment that our forefathers would have enjoyed back in the 19th century, where,
yes,
it was a pristine environment, and you've,
yeah,
got a lot of buffalo, and you've got a 19th century infrastructure, mm-hmm, around to keep people alive.
Right.
You know, what you're talking about is a post-apocalyptic kind of hell.
Yes.
That's covered with radioactivity, poisonous chemical clouds, firestorms in cities, not to mention the massive societal breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Known from hurricane experiences that, you know, 24 hours after the lights go out, the worst elements of society start coming out.
Yes.
Just causing havoc.
Yep.
I mean, in New Orleans, you had snipers, gang members shooting at the cops and at the firemen just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
You know, not
yeah.
Just for the pleasure of causing societal chaos.
Yes, right. Yep, that's right. Well, that makes this all the more baffling. There are two, and these bills have been before Congress for some time. One is called the SHIELD Act. The other is called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, and they're just languishing in Congress. They're not really taking any action on them, and both of those bills could rectify our vulnerability, couldn't it?
Well, actually, we finally, 2015 and 2016 could be the year where we turn this around.
Oh.
As you know from my book, Blackout War, my task force has been out among the states.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to convince, and successfully convincing, state legislatures to take action. You know, because you, even though most states are part of a larger regional grid, you can do what's called islanding. And this was a recommendation of the EMP Commission. States should go ahead and protect themselves. You know, if you put in the Faraday cages and the blocking devices and the surge arresters and the critical assets within your state, you can keep the lights on in your state and avoid these catastrophic consequences. Even if other states around you haven't done it, you know, you can enhance the survivability of your own state by islanding it. And we've succeeded in getting legislation passed for this in Maine, Virginia, and Florida, and Arizona.
That's excellent.
Now, I think that got noticed at the federal level, you know, because at the same time, we've been pushing for a national solution for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this past year, we actually did get the SHIELD Act passed. The SHIELD Act was the chairman of a particular committee who had been holding us up for many years suddenly got religion on this issue and decided to pass a number of provisions to try to protect the grid by providing spare parts for the grid. But he also included the essential language of the SHIELD Act in that bill. So it passed the House, hasn't passed the Senate yet, but that part of the bill passed the House and has gone over to the Senate.
Very good news.
The Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, which I consider to be even far more important than the SHIELD Act, actually, at this juncture. It's a better bill for protecting the country and accomplishes a lot more. It has been even more successful, and it passed the House unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
And then it passed the Senate Homeland Security Committee unanimously. And now it's awaiting a vote in front of the full Senate. So, you know, we've had several provisions. There's been after years of nothing happening in Washington, we finally started to see movement happen.
Yeah.
Now, I would not look to Washington, though, to solve this problem.
Right.
You know, I'm always ready to be disappointed by incompetent politics in Washington.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would still urge everybody, all of your listeners, to look to the states, look to your communities, you know, and launch state initiatives,
mm-hmm.
attack the bridge from both ends.
Yeah,
you know, don't just trust in Washington to solve this problem.
Yeah,
the fact of the matter is, I think the further away you get from Washington, in my experience, the more competent you find state and local governments.
Mm-hmm.
The lower you go and get closer to the wisdom of the people, the wiser government tends to be.
Yeah.
And I think local and state governments will tend to come up with better solutions, solutions better crafted for the state and community that people live in than you will with a one-size-fits-all kind of thing coming out of Washington.
Yeah.
If Washington actually does overcome its competence and corruption and finally do the right thing.
Yes.
Let us not slow down the successes that are happening at the state and local levels by hoping Washington will rescue us in the end by finally doing its job.
Yes. Yeah, that's That's very good news, actually. I was not aware of that, so that is a glimmer of hope.
It is good news.
Yeah.
And it's given me. I'm actually. We may finally have. I don't know if we've gotten over the top of the mountain, but we've certainly gotten near the top. And who knows? The years 2015, 2016, might be the pivotal moment. You know, because of this breakthrough we've achieved in Washington, combined with the progress we've been making at the level of the states, to finally get a handle on this problem and do the really simple and rather inexpensive things that need to be done, you know, to protect the electric grid and other critical infrastructures.
Yes, yeah.
And save our civilization from the worst threat that we've ever faced.
Yes, yeah. You mentioned something a few moments ago, Peter. You mentioned Faraday cages, and I'm wondering if you could explain exactly what that is for our listeners, because they might be scratching their heads saying, Faraday cage? I've never heard of that. What does that mean?
Yeah, a Faraday cage is basically one of the simplest technologies for protecting against an EMP. And in effect, what it is, it's a three-dimensional box, you know, that you put around the electronics you're trying to protect, and it short circuits the EMP, so the EMP is stopped from going into the electronics that you're trying to protect, and it just circulates. You get a current that goes around into the Faraday cage.
Yeah.
An example of this is you can actually make a Faraday cage at home if you've got sensitive electronics, communications equipment, or maybe medical equipment, or spare electronic parts for your car, that you want to protect so that you could repair your car in the aftermath of an EMP. What you could do is, put them in a plastic bag, and then put the plastic bag inside of a metal garbage can with a tight-fitting lid. And there you go. That's a makeshift Faraday cage that will work quite well. The reason you're putting the electronics inside of a garbage bag, a plastic bag, is because you don't want the electronics to come in contact with the sides, the metal interior of of the garbage can. Because if they do, then the EMP or the pulse, the current, will be transmitted, could be transmitted, through the metal wall and get into it. So it's got to be basically insulated.
Yes.
But something as simple as that, that's basically what a Faraday cage is.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even have to be solid. You can make a Faraday cage out of chicken wire too. As long as it's enclosing completely, the thing you're trying to protect, the chicken wire can be, as long as it's in three dimensions, so you can get a so that you'll have an electromagnetically contiguous circuit that can be formed. You can protect it that way, as well. You can turn a metal garage into a Faraday cage by that means. Even if it has windows, if you put chicken wire over the windows and connect the chicken wire with the metal sides of the garage so that a current will flow through it, have a metal door, and you can design a metal garage so that you could park your car inside of a Faraday cage and protect it in that way.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's a good segue into what I'd like for you to share with our listeners next, Peter. I know one of the most valuable aspects of your book, Blackout Wars, is that you talk about what kind of preparations people can make to protect themselves against all of the negative things that we've been talking about, and, of course, the potential long-term loss of electricity. What can the average citizen do to begin to prepare for this kind of potential catastrophe?
Well, first, I would recommend that people be politically active as your first line of defense.
Good point.
Write your congressman, write your senator, write your state representative, your governor.
Yeah.
Call your utilities and let them know you want your grid protected.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't cost you anything, okay? Wouldn't it be much better if you didn't have to undertake preparations?
That's right.
Various levels of government and utilities finally did their jobs and protected the grid. So that's the first thing that I would recommend in terms of protecting your families and communities, because that's the easiest thing to do. yeah. get the guys that are supposed to be protecting you to do their jobs.
Yes.
However, we all know that we, unfortunately, in this day and age, you know, government can't be trusted to do its job. And so
right.
prudent people like yep. myself, yep. you know, have to take measures to protect your families and your
mm-hmm.
Basic protection involves the same kind of protection that you would undertake for any kind of a catastrophic or crisis scenario where society might be in chaos. You know, make sure you've got a food supply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make sure you've got a plan for your family. Are you safe where you live? Are you living in a big city, you know, where you're likely to be, you know, where societal chaos breaks out? Are you in a part of a city where you feel more comfortable?
Yeah.
If not, if you think you're vulnerable, well, do you have friends in the country, or do you have land in the country? Do you know anybody that you could form a plan with, have an agreement so that you could get out of there, and have a plan for all your family members, you know, to get out of there? It doesn't mean that you have to leave a city necessarily. I mean, you know, people in the suburbs, and even in people in the inner city, take steps to protect yourselves,
yeah.
you know, arm yourself, make sure you've got a food supply. You know, so even if you don't have friends so that you can't get out, and traveling might not be the safest thing. You might want to think about that, about
yes.
what is the area like that I live in.
Yeah.
You know, usually if you don't have to move, staying where you are is usually the best and safest thing.
Yeah.
But you want to have food. You want to have a means of protecting yourself. You want to have a medicine kit and know how to use it.
Yes.
It'd be good to have communications, battery-operated radio.
Mm-hmm.
Better yet, a battery-operated, you know, ham radio of some kind so that you can keep track of the news and what's going on. If you are not in an apartment building, you own your own home, you should probably get an electrical generator, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not that you constantly run it, but so that you'd be able and have a fuel supply so that you could run it when you need it, you know. Have a water supply and know how to use it.
Yeah.
You can get a water filter. In fact, you can make makeshift water filters with a garbage can, with blankets, and sand, and charcoal.
Mm-hmm.
That would be quite effective. That decontaminated even the foulest water.
Yeah.
You know, it just takes time. But there are water filters people can buy. There are comfortable ways of ensuring yourself a large water supply by the family swimming pool, for example. You can drink that water. I mean, typically that's 20,000 gallons. It would be enough water to last you for a very protracted time indeed,
yeah.
if you could keep that running and keep it decontaminated. Local communities, and this is applicable to people too, but I would encourage all fire departments and police departments to invest, you know, $50 to have a hand siphon so that you'd be
yeah.
able to go to the gas stations
mm-hmm.
and siphon gasoline, because the gas pumps won't work without
right.
electricity.
Yeah.
But you can keep your fire trucks running, your police trucks running, and your ambulances running by siphoning that gasoline. You can siphon gasoline to use in the emergency generators at hospitals. So if you have a plan, if your local emergency responders have a plan for rationing that gasoline and keeping the essential critical elements of your community going, the hospitals, the police, and fire, you know, you'd be ready for anything, really.
Yeah.
You know, and that would be a prudent thing to do.
Yeah. Have a plan.
Parents,
yeah. Go ahead.
Have a plan. You know, start
yeah.
with a plan.
Yeah.
Start with taking an inventory.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do I have in my family? What
yes.
is their food consumption?
Yes.
You know, how much food am I going to need? And don't, I wouldn't, this is, in some senses, this is an opportunity to have to store up all that bad stuff that you probably don't normally eat. You know, you don't want to waste your precious space having diet foods.
Right.
You know, what you want are foods that have high energy content.
Yes.
Candy bar, peanut butter,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yes.
Canned stuff so that, you know, people go through a lot of trouble about, you know, freeze-dried and stuff like that. Almost nothing is better than canned food, because rats and rodents can't get at it.
That's right.
And we know that canned goods can remain edible for over a century,
yeah.
Even though they might have expiration dates on them. most of those expiration dates doesn't mean that if you eat it after the expiration date, you're going to die or anything.
That's true.
Mostly
yeah.
That's for the food coloring and the flavorfulness of the food.
Yes.
You know, there was an Arctic expedition before the American Civil War that was from the British that went that was lost in the Arctic area around mid 1840s, and in the, in the 20th century, about a century and a half after that expedition was lost, you know, we recovered some of the canned foods that they had taken with them because that was a new thing. You know, canned foods.
Yeah.
It was still edible.
Wow.
Even after, you know, even after a century, a century and a half.
Yeah.
So, you know, my parents had never heard of EMP, the great generation that had survived the Great Depression and World War II and had seen government fail in war and peace. They were all today what we would call survivalists, Republicans and Democrats alike, you know.
Yes.
Because people had seen government fail. They were always expecting another Great Depression or maybe a nuclear war or something to go
yes.
wrong. And, you know, this was a widespread view among that generation, that great generation.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the case with my parents, as it was with our neighbors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we lived on, you know, a quarter of an acre, and almost every inch of it my mother had cultivated and turned into a garden. She was constantly canning goods. You know, we had a food supply that was more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
My father taught us to hunt and fish,
yep.
not just for recreation.
That's right.
This is how he fed his family through the Great Depression.
Yeah.
He got protein for the family by hunting woodchucks, which they called Uber hogs during the Great Depression.
Yes.
And even though they had never heard of EMP,
mm-hmm.
by taking these common sense, basic preparedness measures, you know, they would have been able to not only survive, but they probably would have had a good time, you know. So you can prepare yourself, you know, against EMP. And as I said, even in terms of protecting specific electronics, you know, you can make up your own makeshift Faraday cage. You can harden your personal automobile. Well, probably, you know, it's a myth that you need to buy a pre-1970s car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that all the modern cars cannot be protected. You can protect modern automobiles against EMP, you know, if you insulate them properly.
Yeah.
The local electronics stores will sell what's called ferrite tubes.
Mm-hmm.
These are flexible plastic tubes that have been impregnated with metal, so that they're basically like a Faraday cage that you can wrap around
yes.
the wires
uh-huh.
of your cars.
Yeah.
And if you cover all the long wires of your cars, you know, as a first step, okay, that would greatly increase the chances that your car won't be knocked out, you know, by an EMP, because the EMP won't directly couple into the semiconductors and the fine electronics in your car.
Mm-hmm.
The wavelength of the EMP is about 18 inches, even from a super EMP weapon, about 1.5 feet. And objects smaller than that won't be affected by the wave. So what the EMP needs to do is it couples into the long wires that are 1.5 feet long, and then it finds its way into the semiconductors and burns them out that way. But if you can deny the EMP access to those wires in the first place, so, you know, I think the material cost would be less than $100 to get enough ferrite tubes to harden an average automobile.
Good investment.
You could do it yourself. You could hire. It'd cost more because you'd have to hire a mechanic. It
yeah.
might take 2 hours for a professional mechanic
yeah.
to wire up, you know, to put the ferrite tubes on your car. And there are more sophisticated things you can do that would cost more, like putting rubber washers to isolate the whole engine compartment from the body of the car. But even if you just put in the ferrite tubes, you know, you'd go from being, like, really vulnerable to EMP to very significantly reducing the vulnerability of your family car to an EMP.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of websites that folks can visit to get more information, a lot of good articles, securethegrid.com, securethegrid.com. And Peter, is this one still a good one? EMP Task Force NHS.com?
Yeah, that's my
That's yours.
EMPTaskForce.org is my website.
Okay. Peter is the author of three books, Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, Electric Armageddon, and I highly recommend Blackout Wars. That will give you pretty much everything you need to know, get you up to speed in a hurry on this issue, and also what we've been discussing here the last few minutes. It's going to give you some good practical advice on some things that you can do that are not expensive that you can do to help prepare yourself. Peter, any other books you've got on your mind you want to write, you want to let us know about early, or any new projects you're involved in?
Well, another thing the Congress did was it reestablished the Congressional EMP Commission. And I'm in the process of helping my old chairman. All the original EMP commissioners are coming back, and I'm in the process of helping them establish that commission. At the same time, I'm continuing to run my own EMP task force, which is a congressional advisory board. That's not as august as an official congressional commission. You know, an advisory board is, we don't have the legal powers that a congressional commission does or the resources that a congressional commission does, but it enables us to go out to the states. Right now, we're focusing on, well, one of the states we're going to is Texas, because Senator Hall and Governor Abbott have expressed interest in getting their state protected. And, basically, I've been trying to, I came back from Missouri just this past weekend. I was out at the National Security Action Summit in Missouri and spoke to an audience there to encourage them to harden their state. So I'm continuing to try to press attacking the bridge at both ends, from the federal level and from the level of the state. The Blackout Wars book was just published, one of the, at the end of last year, at the end of 2015. And one of the virtues it has, in addition to what we've been talking about, is it has model legislation.
Mm.
So anybody who wants to protect their state, there's model legislation in there. It has all the legislation from states that have already taken these initiatives, but it also has legislation which is generic, so that all you have to do is fill in the name of your state, and if you could get your governor or a state legislature to pass that legislation or to pass an executive order, start the process of protecting your state, from EMP. So those are the projects I'm focusing on and continuing to work. I feel if I can get this country protected against this, still, it's probably the least understood weapon of mass destruction threat
yes.
to our society.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's the most imminent and the most dangerous.
Yes.
And if I can spend, if on the balance of my life when I'm finally done, if I can push the ball forward to get this country protected, I will consider that to have been time well spent.
Yes.
And I would say to all of your audience members that if you were to protect your families and communities, do what you can to protect your state and your country, it will be time well spent for you. It's like those of us who have been involved in the struggle, we're sort of like the backbenchers who surrounded Winston Churchill just before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, Churchill wasn't able to get the elites of Europe to listen to him.
Right.
Let's not make that mistake again.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get up the rakes and pitchforks and bring them on to Washington, bring them to your state capital.
Yeah.
Make a fuss.
Yeah.
Get this country protected.
Yeah.
Before it's too late.
Right. Yeah. Excellent advice and encouragement, Peter. I appreciate that very much. Thank you for joining me on Soaring Eagle Radio.
Well, thank you so much for giving me a forum and for yourself becoming part of the solution.
Yes.
Every time we educate people about this, we make progress.
Yes. Yes. Amen. Thank you so much, my friend. God bless. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.